Improve your money smarts by listening to this edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 1st. Happy May Day to you. And I hope you stay tuned to find out why Wisconsinites are better than most when it comes to financial literacy. We'll continue our series on getting the most out of Social Security and Medicare. And also, we will hear some high-tech spring cleaning tips. Plus, certified financial planner Kevin McKinley will answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And by the way, we have hit 4,000 friends on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I promised a shout out to number 4,000, and it is Melissa Grainer. So thank you, Melissa, and thanks to all of you who have liked the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let's welcome Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
How are you doing on this fine morning?
I am well, and you?
I'm doing very well, too. Looking forward to a day when it's going to be in the 60s and 70s. So we're going to get back to some nice temperatures here. You know, I have been following financial literacy going on this month and Smart Money Week and all these other things. You say that Wisconsin residents are much better than most when it comes to our money smarts?
Well, that's right. It seems like a good time to note that yesterday was the end of National Financial Literacy Month, and the day before marked the last day of Money Smart Week in Wisconsin. And it seems like a good time to note that state residents have excellent credit scores. Now, this is something that rates our ability to repay the debt that we take on and manage it responsibly. And Experian, which is one of the three largest credit reporting bureaus, just said that Wisconsin residents, their average credit score is 10th in the country at 707. The average score is 687. Another score was put out by a company called Mortgage Marvel, where they tracked the FICO scores of all the people who applied for mortgages in a particular state. And Wisconsin's FICO score ranked third, just behind California and Oregon. And then last fall, Experian released a state-by-state counting of which town or city's residents had the highest credit score. And Wausau was number one in the country, and other Wisconsin cities did very well out of several hundred surveyed. Madison was third, Green Bay was sixth, La Crosse was 10th, and Milwaukee was 33rd.
Boy, that's pretty darn good. Is it something in the water? Why are we doing so well?
Well, I think part of it is cultural. One of the reasons I like living and working in Wisconsin and serving people on a financial basis is that people in the Wisconsin area and the upper Midwest generally are less likely to brag about how much their car cost and much more likely to brag about how many odometer miles they have on the car that they currently have. And people, I have 152,000 on my Toyota. I've had it. A lot of people in Wisconsin did not get caught up in the housing bubble. They didn't overspend, or the prices just didn't appreciate so much that they got in over their head. Incomes during the last downturn remained fairly steady, and one of the people talking about that Mortgage Marvel score from the Cato Institute said that part of the reason that those scores were very high is it reflected a high degree of financial literacy in that particular state's residents.
Well, yay for us. So remind us why our credit score is so important.
Well, borrowing money is just one reason. You're more likely to get the best rates and actually able to get the loan if you have a very good credit score. But also, your credit score can affect how much you pay for auto insurance, for homeowners insurance. It can affect your employment possibilities. Sometimes employers can look at your credit history to decide if you're a candidate that they can take on. And I think in the future, this is going to become more common, sadly. Your credit score and your ability to repay your debts is going to affect the kind of health care that you can qualify for, because not all health care is going to be covered by someone just submitting a claim to an insurance company or Medicare. Some of it's going to be based on your ability to repay that care out of yourself. So it's a good thing to have that score up as high as it possibly can be when you need it.
So what do you do to keep your credit score high or to improve your credit score?
The main thing for people who have a problem with their credit score, then that it's below average, is to make sure you pay at least the minimum bill on time every single month for money that you've borrowed, whether it's a credit card or student loan, car loan, or mortgage payment. Don't apply too much. If you're always applying for those 0% teaser offers that you get from the credit card companies, eventually your constant applications will draw your credit score down somewhat. You want to keep your balances at acceptable levels. A lot of people who pay their debt off every single month are surprised to find out that their credit score isn't as high as if they carried a small balance every single month. But you have to realize that if you carry a small balance, you're paying interest on that likely, so you have to weigh the cost of the interest versus the benefit to your credit score. You also want to check your credit score, make sure that it's accurate, that the information that's being used is up to date and right on. So go to annualcreditreport.com, and you can get one free report per bureau every single year. And then if you want to know your actual FICO score, go to myfico.com. And that costs about $15, but it's definitely worth it. And we'll have a link up to those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for everyone. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time for the On Your Money email bag. Paul says, can you please explain to me what options I would have for cashing in an IRA? I realize it depends on the financial institution, in this case, Hartford, but I am concerned about the potential problems and pitfalls. Also, can you please explain how a rollover works? Many thanks. I really enjoy this program.
Oh, just at the last minute, right. Paul realized that we don't answer any questions without false praise, and he got all the way through the questions. Oh, shoot, I forgot to throw in the false praise. I'll just tag it on at the end.
But just in time, Paul.
Just barely made it, Paul. Good for you. There are several reasons to be concerned here, one of which is why an IRA might be cashed in, as it were, and any potential costs that might be incurred by doing that, and also the technical issues of using a rollover. It has to be done properly. It's fairly easy to do, but if it's done incorrectly, it can end up costing people a lot of money and in penalties and taxes.
So why don't we talk about those?
Well, you can pull money out of an IRA even if you're not retired and you're not 59 and a half. You will still pay taxes generally on the money that you pull out, but you can do it without penalty for certain reasons. Usually, it has to be for unreimbursed medical expenses or health insurance if you're unemployed, first-time home purchase, and then also qualified higher education expenses for you or your spouse or your kids or your grandchildren. But after that, I get a little concerned about saying, well, I just want to cash out of this IRA because I need the money, or versus saying I just don't like the investment. If you're doing it because you need the money, you may want to try to do it 50% in each successive calendar tax year, meaning let's say you had $50,000 in IRA, you need the money, and you're going to pull it out. You're worried about paying the taxes. You may want to do $25,000 in 2012 and then do another $25,000 in 2013. And the way the tax schedule works, you'll probably pay less taxes overall than if you were to pull the money out all in one big lump sum. Now, if you are unhappy with the investment for whatever reason, then you may want to just move it to a different IRA that has other more suitable investment options within it.
So what kind of cost might he incur for cashing out of the IRA?
Well, besides the taxes, when Paul mentioned Hartford, Hartford's a fine enough financial services provider, but I have a concern that it might be within an annuity. And if there is an annuity, there's a couple dangers in pulling the money out. First of all, he might incur a surrender charge, meaning he might lose a percentage of the money that's in the account that has been an early sales charge if he pulls it out. Also, he might lose any income or death benefits that are attendant with that annuity. And he might say, well, yeah, I'm paying for those with with higher fees and expenses. That's part of the reason I want to pull this out. That's fine, but understand that there might be a significant benefit to that annuity to leaving it in there. So he definitely needs to weigh out all these factors before he cashes out of the account, especially if it is an annuity.
Paul also wanted you to explain how a rollover works.
It's basically making sure that if you do move the money from one retirement account to another and you don't need the money, that you don't pay taxes and penalties on it. What you need to do is establish a new IRA, a new jar, if you will, at your new provider. It can be a credit union or a bank or a mutual fund or a financial services company, and then have them initiate the withdrawal from your old IRA, and then they may transfer it electronically. They also may do it the check to the directly sent to the new provider, and they may even, the old IRA provider may even send a check directly to your house, but it will be made out like IRA for benefit of Joy Cardine, account number blah 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 at blah 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 credit union, so that you not only can't cash it, but that you don't cash it and then incur the penalties and taxes.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You know, Kevin, tomorrow at this time we are going to be in our One Day Wednesday pledge drive. It's One Day Wednesday tomorrow. We are going to be trying to raise as many pledges in one day that we typically do in about a week. So you don't have to participate during One Day Wednesday, but we thought that you might want to encourage listeners to pledge now or pledge tomorrow to help pay for Wisconsin Public Radio.
Spend less, pledge more. Is that what you're saying,
Joy? Yes, exactly.
All right. Yeah, I would. I think that I've been very happy with how people have supported the show, but I also like it when they pledge just because they're supporting Wisconsin Public Radio, and I am very honored to be a part of this wonderful organization, and the deeper I get into it, the more impressed that I am. And so, yes, people, we are not going to do a pledge on our show. We will be doing one in the future, but if you have a few bucks, send it along tomorrow. Show you care, and it's, you know, an ersatz demonstration of your support for On Your Money and all the great programming that you get on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can help make One Day Wednesday a success by giving your gift early. You can give now, and you can track our progress at WPR.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley, who is here with information and advice on your money. And our first caller is Brad in Mequon. Hello, Brad.
Yes. My question is, I'm approaching into my late 50s and thinking about possible Social Security. And several people said, well, if you wait till you're 70, you get a significantly higher payment than if you take it at 66, which is what I would get full Social Security at 62 when it's reduced. Well, I look at some actuarial tables, and it turns out that the payout of the three converges around age 80. So I would get a certain amount of money between 62 and 80, the same amount between 66 and 80, the same amount between 70 and 80, and I'm sure the people at Social Security are looking at the same actuarial tables or similar ones that I was, which means you really don't make out unless you beat the actuarial tables. And then I got out from, of course, I took a long time ago, the old present value of money. And so I factored that in, and it turns out, you know, that you don't actually come ahead by deferring Social Security unless you're going to get to, at least for a male, 83, 84, 85. And so I'm thinking and looking at that, and I'm thinking, it seems like a bird in the hand, it's better to take it early rather than say, oh, I think I'm going to be around in my mid-80s.
Did you tell Brad what to say, Kevin?
Actually, I'm jotting some things down. I'm learning as we speak. Could you go on, Brad? Should I take out a new mortgage? And if I do, should it be a 30-year or should I just stick with the 15?
Brad, very, very smart, because it sounds like, Kevin, you've said similar things on this show, yes?
Yes, and it is a big decision, so Brad's diligence is to be commended. But, Brad, good news for you. If you can hang on for about 15 more minutes, we're going to answer this as part of our Smart Asset segment. But you're right. The issue is, you tell me how long you're going to live, what kind of money you're going to need between now and then, and what will happen in the world financially, and I'll tell you exactly when you should take Social Security. Otherwise, I am a firm believer that I would rather have that bird in the hand.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll be listening in 15 minutes.
All right. Well,
good. At least we'll have one person listening in 15 minutes. Good. That should double the ratings.
Right. Stay tuned, Brad. And very smart advice. Pam in Union Grove is with us. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I'll still be listening in 15 minutes.
Good.
I love your show, so thanks. I've learned a lot. Never called in yet. I'm 51, and I'm basically starting over. Lots of medical bills, debt, business, that sort of thing. So no money in the bank. Make a good salary. I have no retirement account. And two kids going to college in 2 to 3 years. So I just would like, is there any clear indication whether I should be putting my money into retirement and taking out loans for the students? Or should I be paying for their college and adding the retirement as can? I've got about $20,000 in debt left, but it's all under 5%. But I'm planning to pay that off this year, too.
Great. Well, interestingly enough, Pam, that the amount of debt that you have is actually less than the average amount that a student owes who graduates from college right now,
yeah,
or at least one who has debt. So, and are you a homeowner or you,
yes,
rent an apartment? Okay.
With a mortgage.
With a mortgage, good.
Yeah.
And in all those years before this time, Pam, were you working? Were you paying into Social Security?
I was paying in to Social Security, except for about 10 years when I was a teacher in Illinois, and they had their own retirement.
Great, outside of the Social Security system. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, the good news is, and this is something that should hopefully enlighten you. First of all, I don't want you to pay for their college. I want them to borrow the money to do it, and you to help them either get through college when there is no more money to borrow, or to make the loan payments on the money that they do borrow once they get out of school, because they have 40 years at least of life to pay those loans back, and you do not have 40 years to work and save for retirement. So, and if they're smart, they'll say, hey, Mom, no offense, we don't want you to come and live with us in your late 80s, so you save for your own retirement, we'll figure out paying for college. So I definitely want you to gear towards that. Second of all, If you qualify, Pam, I'd like you to save the money that you can accumulate for retirement. First of all, get any employer's match. Does your employer have a match in a 401k at work?
No, they don't.
Okay. Then if you think you're going to need this money, if you don't have a substantial amount of savings set aside, and by substantial, I mean usually a year's worth of living expenses, and you don't get a match, I'd just as soon have you set the money aside into a Roth IRA. And because you are 51, you can contribute up to $6,000 per year or your earnings, whichever is less. And the nice thing about the Roth IRA is you don't get a tax deduction on the deposit, but you can pull the contribution back out whenever you want, at any time, for any reason, with no taxes or penalties. So if you're still kind of precarious on your finances and say, I got this cash, but I don't know what to do with it, and I might need it, the Roth IRA does allow you to save for retirement, and it's tax-free in retirement, which is important. Finally, have some faith, because that home that you are, you're paying off the mortgage and hopefully building up some equity, that can represent an asset from which you can draw in retirement. And then more importantly, the Social Security that you've paid into all these years. The great thing about having a business, raising kids, and struggling from paycheck to paycheck, the very tiny silver lining in that is you learn to live on relatively little money, and you are going to get relatively little money from Social Security, but it will be there, and you're going to get, and you'll be surprised. I mean, the value can be worth several hundred thousand dollars to some people who've paid in. So that's going to be a portion of the expenses you need for retirement. And then other people way less resourceful than you have survived as a retiree by Social Security, managing their expenses, maybe having a little bit of cash set aside and picking up some part-time earnings and using their home equity. And so you're right to call. I'm glad to hear you're taking the bull by the horns here, but just do the Roth IRA. Don't pay off any debt that you don't absolutely have to for the time being, and definitely put the, this is a generational thing here. Let's keep kicking the debt can down the road and put it on our children and grandchildren rather than paying the bills ourselves. And I don't want you to veer from that. Come on, we all agreed at the meeting here.
That's excellent. I didn't know most of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Pam, very much, and good luck to you. Our next caller is Joshua in Wales. Hello, Joshua.
Good morning, Joy and Kevin. How are you guys?
Very well.
Good. Kevin, I have a question. We have a son leaving for college in the fall, and he got a very small loan through the FAFSA program, but not much besides that. And we're looking at either doing the Parent Plus loan or doing the something through Wells Fargo or one of the other big banks that do student loans. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on those two options.
Okay. Do you have other assets that, in theory anyway, you could use to either pay for this or at least to make the payments on the loans in the future?
Yes.
Okay. Good. I'd still rather have most parents, especially if you trust yourself to not spend that money otherwise, to get loans, because you can always pay the loans off, and but the loans may either not be there in a couple years, or they might be there with much more burdensome interest rates or terms. And so I would have you take the loan out now. And keep in mind, when we hear about student loan balances and you hear, you know, the average balance is $25,000, that's a lot of money to me, and I'm sure it is to a 50-year-old parent or a 25-year-old college graduate. But at $25,000, a kid can pay off those student loans in 10 years by making about a $250 payment per month, which is certainly a lot of money, but it's $3,000 per year. And if you don't think that, you know, borrowing the money to go to college is going to provide you with at least a $3,000 a year advantage in your income, especially over your whole life, you probably shouldn't be going to college right now anyway. So yeah, if those are the only loans you can get, I would get them. I wouldn't go crazy, and I'd pay very close attention to the interest rates and the terms of the loan to make sure that you're not going to be hurt somewhere down the road if something changes on those loans. Do you own a home, Joshua, too?
Yeah, we own a home, and then we own a business building as well. And the other option I had thought of was maybe refinancing the business building and using some of the equity in that. We would just like to, you know, we want to encourage our son to pay for most of his college. So we are hoping that he'll either pay us back if we take out the loan, or that his name is on the loan as well. So
And that's a very good idea. And it's not a bad idea to get to have the kids have some skin in the game and say, hey, get through this, because you take on another year. Because you're goofing around or you're not applying yourself in class, it's going to add another $25,000 or so to this bill, and that's going to mean a huge amount of money to you. So we're not going to necessarily just cover that if we don't feel like you're applying yourself. Do you have the possibility, Joshua, of a new mortgage on your primary home?
We just refinanced not too long ago, probably a year ago or so. I suppose we could look at that again.
Did you do the 80% and do a 30-year mortgage, 80% loan to value?
Well, we just lowered the interest rate and extended it out to 30 years again, but we didn't take any equity out. We just lowered the monthly payment, basically.
Okay, that's maybe where I would go first, is at least go back and find out for sure and say, hey, can we get a new 30-year 4% mortgage, and if so, how much can we get the cash out? Because that gives you 30 years to pay whatever you get out of it, and I bet you have enough equity in there. You can at least get a year or two out of that, and then also get the parent loan if you'd like. But actually, I'd go to the mortgage first, because it does buy you a lot more flexibility and a much lower payment, and gives you a little bit more time to, again, kick the can down the road.
All right, thanks. I hope that works out, Joshua. We go now to Rose in Ashland. Hello,
Hi.
Rose.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have an anecdotal story related to that advice you gave about carrying a small balance on the credit card. I had always paid my card in full, and then after hearing that advice several months ago, I decided to hold back $100 for my credit card bill. Mm-hmm. And then I paid it in full the next month. And over those 2 months of credit card bills, I was charged $40 on that $100, because they charge you on all the purchases you make in the time period that you're holding that you owe on your bill. So I called and complained. I was furious. I couldn't believe that it was that much money. I called and complained, and I called the state attorney general's office and complained. They did refund or did take that charge off, but I will never do that again.
That's it, and they probably backstopped themselves, Rose, by saying, well, ma'am, it's in the terms of the agreement, right?
Oh, of course.
Of course. It's a good lesson, Rose, not just about the potential cost of the interest. Not every credit card does this. Most people don't have these kinds of charges for those. I assume you must charge up a pretty big dollar amount and then pay it off, correct?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Not every card will bill this. Not every card's billing of this. But people, you really have to read those little tissues. You know, the marketing thing comes in giant, beautiful, 24-point font, 0%. interest. The actual things that affect you are going to come in the tiniest, tiniest print that you can possibly imagine. They're going to be very innocuous. It's going to say important information on the front, but it also says important information on the front of the mailer when they're trying to sell you, you know, travel insurance or something. So you definitely have to read this. Banks are really struggling to try to figure out how to make money off of their customers, and they're becoming very creative to try to stay one step ahead of the law and one step ahead of the customers. And it's not that they're doing anything illegal, but the laws keep changing. The laws have changed to actually hurt banks. And you know, a lot of people would say, well, boo-hoo, I feel really sorry for these poor people. But they need to do that. They're a business, and they provide a service. Now, the terms, though, are where they can get you, because they say, look, do you agree to this? And, of course, nobody ever reads those terms. And they say, yeah, that's fine. And then you come back to get bitten by this. So I'm glad that you complained about it, Rose. You were right to do that. But definitely pay attention to the terms. That's been very illustrative for people who are listening.
Yeah. Now, Kevin, Rose said that she was carrying a small balance on her credit card bill, thinking you had advised this. I don't remember what benefit you would have to carrying a small balance on your credit card.
I don't remember that either, yeah. But I say a lot of things that I don't pay attention to while I'm talking. So, I that's actually fairly common wisdom, but as we've talked about in the past, yes, your credit score will be slightly higher if you carry a balance. One of the things that many credit scores demarcate, if you will, mm-hmm. is not just if you're going to pay your bills off on time, but also how profitable of a customer you will be for the institution. So if you pay your bills off every time, you don't make very much money for them. Therefore, you won't be a very profitable customer. And so it is slightly better, but typically, and like we've seen in Rose's case, the cost of the interest in carrying the balance may be higher than any perceived benefit from the advantage in the credit score.
Right, and good for you, Rose, for getting that charge taken off your credit card bill. Time now for smart assets, Kevin. We touched on this last week. A recent report from the federal government is warning us over the financial stability of Social Security and Medicare, and over the coming weeks, we are going to address what we can do to get the most benefit from Social Security and Medicare.
Yes, and it's actually all three very important things to American Social Security, the Social Security Disability Program, and Medicare. And one of the things that I find kind of humorous is when people, and especially political leaders, jump up and down about how terrible Social Security is and what awful shape it's in, and we have to do something right now to fix it. Medicare and the Social Security Disability Program are in much, much worse shape than the Social Security Retirement Program. So if people are really concerned about fiscal solvency, they'll address those programs first. The problem is there's no easy answer to doing that, and so therefore they don't want to address those problems. They just want to make political hay from trying to say that there's some kind of problem with this Social Security Retirement Program. Actually, there's about $2.6 trillion in surplus in the Social Security Program right now. It's a very crucial component to most people's retirement. The average check is about $1,100 a month, and as we mentioned to one of the previous callers, over 20 years of retirement, $1,100 a month works out to about probably $250,000 or more. It will be there in some shape or form. It's been tinkered with in the past to create the solvency. It'll be tinkered with again, but the problems or the solutions to fixing it are generally fairly small and gradual rather than, hey, you lose your check. But it's important for people who are planning in retirement to know when to take it and, more importantly, maybe how to take it.
Well, let's start with when to take it.
As we mentioned before, sooner is usually better. That allows you to keep any savings you have in your bank account or retirement accounts aside for emergencies. Or if interest rates rise or the stock market falls, there's some better investment opportunities out there. It also, getting that Social Security check right at 62 really helps bridge the gap from, you know, losing a paycheck that you were getting and then getting a new check from Social Security. It probably won't be as large, but at least it is a regular check that you can rely on every single month. It's more reliable than just about any job or investment out there. And it makes it easier to handle the transition from working and getting a paycheck to retirement and spending your savings.
Can anything be done to increase the size of your Social Security check?
Other than waiting, there are a few strategies that might be helpful. Again, you can wait. You get a higher check for every year that you do wait, usually about 7 to 8%, depending on the year in which you were born. But that also means you are 1 year closer to death. And as the previous caller mentioned, you do need to live to probably about 78 to 80 or so just to break even. Another thing you can do to not necessarily increase your check, but to increase your net amount of your check is before you initiate Social Security, start shifting assets from IRAs to Roth IRAs, because right now, withdrawals from Roth IRAs do not make Social Security taxable. Income from just about any other source will make Social Security taxable. And then finally, this is a more detailed strategy, but some couples, married couples, can use what's known as the file and suspend strategy.
How does that work?
Well, let's say over 30 years of marriage, you had the breadwinner was working outside the home, and then you had a stay-at-home member of the married couple. The breadwinner has a higher income, but the stay-at-home spouse, you qualifies for spousal benefits. So what the breadwinner wants to do is file first and then suspend his or her check, meaning I don't want my check right now, but if I file, my stay-at-home spouse can qualify for his or her spousal benefits. So then at 70, the one who has been working, the breadwinner, then initiates his or her check, which is going to be much higher because they've waited. And then upon the death of either one of those people, one of them is probably going to die first, that larger check will go to the survivor, either if it's the breadwinner or the spouse. They'll lose the spousal check, but the breadwinner will get the much higher check. And it allows people to get some income coming in their, usually their mid-60s, but then a much higher check by waiting until 70.
So is there some place we can go to get more specifics on our situations?
Yeah, the Social Security Administration website is actually very helpful, and they don't, you don't feel like, you know, they're protecting you from your money. They're trying to help you get the most things possible. And I would also call some of the local offices. Those people are valiant fighters for people's benefits and trying to make sure you get as much as you can. Some planners are starting to say that they focus on Social Security benefits and strategies. And there are some good ones out there who do that, but sometimes they're just using this as kind of a Trojan horse, if you will, to try to sell you an annuity. So make sure that you're, you know, you're actually getting something that is, that has benefit, rather than it's just a camouflage sales pitch.
We have a caller who has a question about Social Security, so let's take Kay in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Should somebody take, when they're 62, take Social Security, they're still working full-time?
Kate, do you need the money, or do you just think, hey, this might help out?
Might help out.
Okay. All of the things being equal, I prefer you don't take it at 62 if you are still working, and it's three reasons. The first one being is it's going to be piled on top of your earnings so that it is going to be taxable. Second thing is you are going to lose some benefits. The check would be higher if you were to wait. And the third thing is that there still exists that little bugaboo in Social Security where if you do initiate it before normal retirement age and then you earn over a certain amount, meaning it's about $14,280, I think, for 2012. If you earn more than that, you do lose a dollar in Social Security check for each $2 over that level. If you're going to be over that, make more than that, more than about $14,000 of gross income, then you probably do want to wait, because between the lost checks, the extra taxes, and the lost benefits, it's probably not worth it. You're probably only going to end up with about half of the check that you would otherwise get by waiting until you actually do retire.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kay. But if you really, really need it, Kevin?
Yeah, if you need it, take it. It's there. And I would much rather have people take that and just get it and say, let's fix the problems we have right now and get this income going and, again, worry about the bigger issue of having a smaller check later on.
Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us just about every Tuesday at this time for information and advice on your money. If you have a personal finance question, call 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email on yourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We always clean up. You show we really care. We always clean up. Cause we like to do our share.
Apparently, that's Barney and gang talking about cleaning up. And since there are 7 weeks of spring left, we thought that we would devote this segment of On Your Money to some spring cleaning tips. You're going to clean up, Kevin?
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear, by the way, that the On Your Money Choir can have some fun with some of these little bumpers that we do. They're prayer form this morning. Good for you. I don't know that alcohol was allowed in the studios, but
that's Rob Ferret's choice, I believe.
Is there an acoustic version of that song that we could get our hands on? Or not?
Oh, Barney and cleaning up. Anyway, but I am spring cleaning these days, so I'm looking forward to some tips here.
Yeah, usually we devote this portion of the show to the best way to accumulate things, but if you've been either one of the regular listeners to the year, you probably have accumulated a bunch of junk, so we're going to help you try to get rid of it over the next few weeks. Some traditional ways and some not so, cleaning up your financial situation, but today we'll talk about getting rid of stuff that you either don't want or don't need, and today making sure that you don't break the law when you throw out your old electronics.
What is the law that I might break?
In Wisconsin, it's SB 107. It took effect in January of 2010, and it's administered by the DNR. They've recently launched an awareness campaign because they've been finding lots of old PC towers and computer monitors and televisions in the ditches, and they want to let people know that there's a proper way to dispose of these, in part because some of the components of these electronics can be very dangerous if they leach into the soil, but also, with the great rise in commodity prices, some of the components left in these electronics can be very valuable and should be reclaimed.
Seriously, I can't just throw my old TV in the ditch.
No, you just have to just stick with your regular garbage that you just toss out the window on the Beltline.
What else can't I throw in the ditch?
This would be computers, TVs, monitors, printers, cell phones, appliances, whatever. Just about anything that has some type of electronic component is covered by the new law. There can be very significant fines if you are caught not disposing of it properly.
Well, so what should I do if I need to get rid of one of these things?
They've established a roster of qualified recyclers who are participating in the program. You can go to one of these centers, or there are also drop-off sites at many electronics retailers. It's kind of a coordinated effort with retailers and manufacturers as well, and then also what they call e-cyclers. If you can go to dnr.wi.gov and put waste management into the search, you'll get a list where you can find the people who will accept these things and under what terms they will accept these types of items. And we'll have a link to the longer thread up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
1-800-642-1234. If you have a question for Kevin about personal finances or money matters, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And our next caller is Greg in Wausau. Hello, Greg.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, I'm just curious. I want to move my 401ks from a previous employer, and I know there's different types of financial advisors, and I'm not sure if it's how they get paid or how they advise you, and if you could recommend what type is usually the best. I'm in my late 50s, and between me and my wife is about $160,000 or so, and we're just we'd like to get a little closer to us. So,
sure. Do you have anyone you've worked with in the past, Greg, or are you kind of starting afresh?
This was a family friend when I retired from a previous employer, and she moved down to Tennessee, and it's my wife's not happy with her performance, and mine has done pretty well, but we just want it up here, it's just time to change it, so
okay.
I'm not sure. I know there's different ways you get charged. Right.
Yep.
Now the funds are all right, but...
Well, it's interesting. I mentioned how much I like working with people in Wisconsin because of their financial values generally in the culture and the way people think about money in their lives. One of the downsides of this is that people in Wisconsin are hesitant and reticent to ask someone how they actually get paid. And I think it should be one of the first questions you ask when you talk to anybody and say, how much do you get paid off of this? And what can I expect to get off for what I'm paying for it? And if they say, you're not paying anything for this, well, then that's you've either found the Mother Teresa of financial services, or you're probably not getting the straight story. So I would look in the phone book, check with your bank or credit union. They usually have a well-dressed investment person sitting in the lobby. Now, sometimes, again, you have to watch out because sometimes that person has their own commission and their own income at heart first and foremost, and they need to earn a living, but they can't put their own priorities ahead of yours. And you should say, look, if you're going to do this for me, I need to know how much you're charging me, where that money's coming from, and what you will provide for that services. Generally, I'm a bigger fan, Greg, of finding people who are willing to charge you a little over a long period of time rather than a big upfront commission right in the front, because quite frankly, if you pay a big upfront commission, like in an annuity or a mutual fund, the best thing that can happen in the advisor's perspective is that you get hit by a car the minute you give them your money, because they get right to keep all the money and they don't have to serve you anymore. So I'd rather have you have the relationship a little more balanced by paying them a little bit of money. You can look for hourly and fee-based financial planners, but they're very few and far between. You know, there's usually only a couple in most of the communities your size. If you go to fpanet.org, they have a search engine there for people who might serve you on just a fee basis. But I flat out ask people. People say, well, what's your track record or what's, you know, your education? I'm way more interested in what is this going to cost me? How do you get paid? And what can I expect for that cost? And then let, you know, decide if what the person's telling you seems worth working with them.
All right, I really appreciate your help. Thank you.
All right, good luck, Greg. Thanks for calling. Here's an email from Rick. Rick says, I'd like to get your excellent advice, here we go, Kevin, on what criteria to use when we tap into savings to fund traveling in retirement. My wife and I are both retired and fortunate enough to have pensions that cover everyday costs. Now we want to travel and have some mutual funds, 403B accounts, and Roth IRAs. Which should we use first?
Greg, I can't give you excellent advice, but I can give you advice. And that is, when you're in retirement, what you should do is look upon your liquid savings as one giant chicken. And let's say you're very fortunate, you've accumulated $100,000 in your liquid savings. And I want you to take an egg from that chicken every single month in the form of a value that's somewhere around a quarter to a half percent of the value, meaning about $250 to $500 out of $100,000. And put that into your checking account, month in, month out. And know that as that balance builds up, that's money that can be spent on things that your grandfather would probably roll over in his grave if he saw you spending it, but darn it, you earned it, you saved it, and you know that you know, your time is at least as precious to you as your money, and therefore you better do this now while you can. And once you build up that account of eggs, you know that you can break those, you can eat those, you can spend that money, and know that there are going to be new eggs replenishing that account every single month. Again, about a quarter to a half percent per month. We have a very difficult time as human beings, even if, you know, people I work with have $1 million, if they don't have more than a few thousand dollars in their checking account, they feel very broke because they've lived 30 or 40 years paying attention to what's in the checking account, not what their overall net worth is. So this allows you to live off of that money in a sustainable way. And more importantly, enjoy the trip. If you just write a check for $10,000 or $20,000 off the top of your nest egg, the chicken, if you will, you're going to be concerned, like, oh, gosh, we're going to be kicking ourselves somewhere down the road for taking this trip. But if you spend it out of the egg account, you know that it will be replenished at a sustainable rate. And then when it's back up to a level, you can cash in again. Go ahead and eat your eggs.
And happy traveling to Rick. That reminds me, I just booked a trip for the end of June for Washington, D.C. We haven't been there in a long time. We're going to go tour the White House, Kevin. So.
That's our nation's capital, you know.
It is, and it's been a while. Is. So we're going to look at some monuments.
Just go straighten them up out there, will you?
I will. Clean them up a bit. Carl in Eau Claire is with us. Hi, Carl.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thanks for taking my call. My question is for Kevin. I came across I took out a large stock savings of my money from a company I work for on the West Coast, and I didn't buy nothing for about 5 or 6 years on credit. And I went and applied to get credit on an item I wanted to purchase, and I was zeroed out on two of the credit people, two of the credit companies. And I had 680 on, I think it was one of the other credit companies. By me doing that, that is happening, and I'm coming up on retirement. I'm 53 now. Am I hurting myself? Do I need to go out and start purchasing items or what?
You actually, and I'm saying when you say zero out, you mean that they had no credit history for you whatsoever?
They it was just like it was just zero.
It was just zero. You didn't exist, according to them, huh?
No.
Okay.
It feels like I passed away.
Well, in some cases, if the credit company is not aware of your existence, sometimes that can actually be a good thing. But the 680 that you have on the other car is not great, but it's not terrible. That's actually about average right now, if it's your FICO score in America. So, yeah, I would say actually see what cards you can get. You might get a secured card if you can't get a standard credit card. And then what you do is charge $50, you know, fill up your tank of gas or whatever, but then make sure that you pay it off every single month, or keep a, you know, $25 to $50 balance or something if you want to boost it up a little bit more. But that's the best way to boost the score up. And if you take out no new credit, but just take out a secured card or a small credit card, charge a little bit, pay it off, charge a little bit, pay it off, you'd be amazed. You probably see about a 50-point jump in the first 6 months, and if you can keep that up for a whole year, you might see a 75 to 100-point jump in your score. And again, that does save you money in the future on auto and homeowners insurance expenses, and it can help your employability. And most importantly, it just helps you be able to afford better loans and qualify for better loans. So yeah, I would recommend that you do that on a small basis. You don't have to do a whole lot to really boost that score up.
All right, Carl, good luck to you. Nadine in Brooklyn is with us. Hello, Nadine.
Hi. I would like to go back to the IRA question. And my question is, there's a requirement that you start taking money out before 70 and a half. And what's the penalty if you do not?
It's a very good question. It's a very significant penalty, Nadine. The requirement is actually that you take money out by April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half from an IRA. So for most people, they're almost 71 or older by the time that this actually hits. So, and it's usually a very small amount that you're required to take out. But the penalty is that there's a 50% excise tax on what you were supposed to take out, and then you still have to take it out and pay taxes on that amount. So let's say you were supposed to take out $1,000 and you didn't. They would hit you with a $500 excise tax penalty on that $1,000 that you were supposed to take out. And then they'll still say, now take this out, and then hit you with income taxes on it again. So people who are nearing that age should be very cautious about making sure you take out at least the minimum amount every single year.
All right. Thank you, Nadine, and good luck to you. Time now for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, a lot of On Your Money listeners are already on the Do Not Call list, but the state has just added unsolicited texting to cell phones and smartphones to the Do Not Call list. So you may have to go back and re-register. It's at nocall.wisconsin.gov. That's nocall.wisconsin.gov. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, and you will then avoid those strange texts that you get, and you're not sure if it's, you know, someone you want to talk with or someone that is trying to sell you something. And so make sure that you go to nocall.wisconsin.gov. And again, if you don't have time to write that down now, go to onyourmoney.com, and we'll have it up there later on today.
Sounds good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He'll be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Do you have a language pet peeve that literally makes you see red? Basically, you know, we will talk about the words and phrases that tick us off tomorrow at this time. Also, tomorrow at this time, we will be in One Day Wednesday. One Day Wednesday's pledge drive is coming up tomorrow. You can cast your vote for shorter pledge drives by making your gift right now at WPR.org. When you do, you'll help us set the stage for a successful One Day Wednesday. That's WPR.org, and thanks very much. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins, and to Amanda Magnus, who produced this program. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.